unable to participate. Please email me at n2rdb@arrl.net. Or for those of you who are members of Nassau County Aries, you may sign up through the website, www.nassauaries.net. If we have enough participants, we may bring an attempt at NVIS operation into the drill. That is all. N2RDB, back to net.
Very fine, Tim. One last call. Anyone else need any fills on the information Tim is giving us about the simulated emergency test? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, there being none, we're going to go on to Mike. KD2, Alpha Mike Zulu. Our first questioner tonight, you're number one on the runway, Mike. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Dick. This is more of a follow-up to my last week question regarding interference to my TV touch controls. I've been working on a problem now for a week with the advice from the TechNet and everybody and additional people, and I've come to the following conclusion, which seems to work. I had to take my... I created a totally separate ground for my shack, 10-foot rod, 5-foot of cable, that roughly speaking, going to the ground rod. The 100 feet or so of RG58 cable I put into a can, a paint can, coiled it up, and grounded the can itself to form a shield to eliminate that source of RF. And the thing that worked was a UPS onto my TV and a couple of ferrites thrown on any cable I could. All that seemed to work, and my TV is relatively calm now. I haven't had any complaints as of yet, but I want to thank everybody for all the advice and information I received for this RFI problem I had. And I'm still convinced it's really a Part 15 question that when Samsung designed the TVs, they never took into account nearby transmitters. But so be it. I wanted to thank everybody and give the following follow-up there. KD2 AMZ.
Good information, Mike. Is it your best guess from what you can tell that the 110-volt line cord going into both your television set and probably your cable box converter, does the evidence where you put on a UPS and put on ferrite beads and whatever, making an improvement, would it suggest to you that that was probably the major antenna, particularly when I think you said you did get some other peculiar results in the house? I'm trying to remember what it was, a fluorescent light or whatever that behaved in a funny way when you were transmitting, suggesting that the particular physical layout of the wiring of your house happened to be such that it would represent a resonant circuit at your HF operating frequency. So from what you can tell, does that sort of fit the scenario, Mike? KD2 AMZ, K2LIW.
Yes, I would think that would be the case because I use a field strength meter, and when I went to any electrical device or wall outlet or anything that's plugged into my electrical system, whenever I keyed up, my field strength meter would respond. So I'm assuming that my electrical system in the house became a resonant antenna. Now, the reason why I don't think my neighbors were complaining is because there's a transformer right outside my house, and this RF will only go as far as the line transformer on a telephone pole. Andy, W2CDL, suggested I use my oscilloscope, and I haven't done that yet, to actually look at the waveforms and see what it is. And I expect to see that particular frequencies in the 40-meter range appear on top of the 60 cycle. So that's what I kind of expect to see. I just didn't do it yet. I just got to make sure that my oscilloscope is isolated. I'm going to use my Variac to make sure it's isolated so I don't blow up my oscilloscope by going straight to the line, power line. And but the thing that really worked was suggested to me by Rich, I forgot his call sign, to use a UPS, because as we all know, a UPS has a line filtering, it has a charging circuit, and then it goes into a battery, which is a, really like a big giant capacitor. And then the battery feeds an inverter circuit, which creates, doesn't create, it makes whatever, an AC voltage from DC. It's an inverter, so it becomes a rather isolated circuit. And put all that together, and it seemed to solve the problem. It was rather a lot of stuff to do for what I consider to be a
repeater. Time out.
A question, comment, Dick from Mike.
Very fine, John, recognized. I was hearing everything that Mike said in the input. Mike, for the last 30 seconds, you did time out, and he was talking about the fact that the UPS has got a beautiful built-in filter. Also, where Mike talked to us about holding his field strength meter near the socket of the house and seeing a significant deflection of the field strength meter. From my point of view, that's a very strong piece of evidence that the house wiring was the major antenna that was creating the ingress of the RF energy into the affected television set. And yes, the manufacturer of the set apparently didn't do a very good job of making it electromagnetic interference proof, and for some probably good reasons. In other words, the number of amateur radio operators who are going to have that exact problem, that exact brand name, model number of set in a house with wiring that's got, we'll say, 80 meter resonance, and the guy is on 80 meters and gets the problem, it's a relatively rare event. Therefore, to put in the extra filter would cost them quite a few dollars per set, and lots of sets, and maybe only 1% of the population needs it. That was part of the philosophy in the old days by which the FCC used to have a requirement that television sets would have to have a significant number of decibels of filtering for frequencies outside of the television bands, channels 2 through 13, so to speak. And so a high-pass filter was required, but that cost them X number of dollars per set, and they got permission from the FCC to eliminate that filter because only less than 1% of the population required it. And the FCC gave them permission to do that if they would supply it free of charge to those who requested. But the FCC fell down on one particular point, in that they didn't require this hidden warranty to be indicated in the owner's manual. So therefore, it was a hidden warranty that if you talked to the right people on ham radio, you found out about it, but you couldn't find out from your owner's manual that you had this free offer of asking for the filter, and it would be supplied. Let's see what John's got to ask. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
KC2WGB. Glenn recognized. Dick, you may want to caution him on the that auto transformer that he's going to use as a variac. That doesn't give him isolation, and unless it has an isolation transformer built into it, it's got to be a little cautious there. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Good point, John, and this is one of the further points that I was going to tell Mike, and that is making a RFI measurement of a 110-volt line has a number of hidden risks to it. One safe way to do it would be to couple to the 110-volt line by way of, let me pick a number, 10 picofarad capacitors or 100 picofarad capacitors, assuming they have something like a 500-volt rating. That would give you a certain amount of safety because the 10 or 100 picofarad capacitor has got a very high reactance to 60 cycles, but it has a moderately low reactance to 3.5 megahertz, particularly when it's going into a 10 mega ohm input impedance oscilloscope probe. That's one approach. Also, I do want to, after we go over to Glenn and have his comments, I want to give Mike some further information about common mode versus differential mode RF energy on the 60-cycle line. That's another whole, and how to properly use an oscilloscope to make this kind of a measurement. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everybody on the net.
Just a couple of quick comments about radiated and conducted emissions. In this particular case, it sounds like it's a conducted emissions kind of a problem. And just a little bit about what I know about most of the new TV sets that are out today. They're not really designed to FCC specifications. They're really, because they have to be sold worldwide, they meet the FCC and the international. And usually there's like an IEC specification that most of these things have to meet. And typically the standard that they go for is for standard consumer products is 3 volts RMS conducted of basically emissions on the line. And the requirement there is that the there's no disturbance to the equipment at those levels. For the higher industrial standards, they go up to 10 volts RMS conducted emissions. And also, Dick, that's not a very easy measurement to make. Let me let it drop for a second. To get a calibrated measurement of that, you really need what they call a line impedance stabilization network, an LISN. And that's a device that actually has very, very large inductors in series with the power source. And what you're doing is you want to actually look at the what you suspect is the source of that's generating the noise. In this particular case, probably the piece of amateur radio equipment. And I would suspect this is probably the offender, and it may have a power supply that's got a problem more than the TV set. And if he's seeing a lot of hot RF on a lot of the outlets around the house, I would think that maybe putting the filter on the power supply end, in other words, basically build the common mode filter, common mode and differential mode line filter, right at the power supply of his ham radio equipment, that may alleviate a lot of his problems. But I'm going to pass it back to you, to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
KC2QIQ, this is KC2AMZ. I actually tried that, and no, made no difference.
Yeah, Mike, where you held your field strength meter near the wall outlets in the house and saw a significant deflection is a pretty strong indication that the wiring is probably resonant, but certainly heavily coupled to the antenna, regardless of what the distance to the antenna is. Assuming everything else is, the transmission lines are well shielded, so the antenna is made to radiate, and as it radiates, then the nearby wiring has to be a place where it's obviously picking things up. Now, when it comes to making scope measurements of RF energy on a 60-cycle line, the most ideal way to do it, in my opinion, would be to use a two-channel oscilloscope, an oscilloscope that may only have one trace. It doesn't have to be a dual-trace oscilloscope, but one that's got two channels, where it's got the possibility of setting up channel A or channel B or A minus B, A plus B, A minus B. If you're using times 10 oscilloscope probes, which automatically have something like a 1 meg or a 10 megohm input impedance, and if you're using a pair of these probes where one is connected to the hotline and one is connected to the return of the two prongs of the wall, not counting the third, the round one, the safety, and then this oscilloscope is used in first the looking at A only, looking at B only, and then looking at A minus B, you would now be able to tell the difference between differential and common mode. Let me tell you what I mean by this.
Dick, can I add a comment to this also later after you finish? KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you sure can, Glenn. Most likely, both wires of your 110-volt line, the hot and the return, both have very close to the same amount of RF on them because in your household wiring, they're held very close to each other, and both of them are equal antenna. So that if you simply set up an oscilloscope where you measure only the difference in voltage between the hot and the return, and you're looking for RF, there might not be any. Even though both hot and return, the two wires from the plug, the two prongs of the plug, so to speak, might both be hot with reference to ground. In other words, they're both, let me pick numbers. Let's assume now that you've got 10 volts of RF. You got 10 volts of RF on the hot line, 10 volts of RF on the return line, and both of them are equal in amplitude and equal in phase. When you measure each one of those lines one at a time to ground, you would see the 10 volts RMS. if you measured the difference between the two, A minus B, you might see zero, because although there's a lot of voltage there, it is common to both. So whenever you've got a two-wire system and you're making measurements like this, you got to make the measurement both ways, differential and common mode. If you've got the exact same voltage on both wires, that would be called common mode. It's voltage with reference to ground, not with reference to each other, as far as the RF pickup is concerned. So you'll have to do all of those, and you got to worry about the fact that most scope probes, let me drop, most oscilloscope probes have the actual sharp point out front with usually a little hook on the end of it, and if it's a time 10 probe, that goes into a circuit that cuts down the signal by 10 to 1 before sending it to the oscilloscope. And with that times 10 cut down, putting 110 volts of AC in there is probably safe if you're in a high enough voltage range in volts per centimeter on the oscilloscope. That's the good news. But on many oscilloscopes, the other lead, the grounded lead, the one with the clip, with the alligator clip on it, quite often that is grounded to the case of the oscilloscope. And if you made the mistake of connecting that that clip lead of the oscilloscope probe to the hot lead of the 110 volt line, you're going to get smoke and flames, and terrible things are going to happen. If the third prong, the safety wiring of the plug on the oscilloscope is doing its job correctly, you've now created a short circuit, and you're going to be blowing the fuse, and it's going to be some smoke and flames when you do that, when you make that contact. If that safety wiring isn't there, the hold-on case of the oscilloscope could be hot with 110 volts AC, 120 volts AC. You touch that and touch a water pipe, and things are dangerous. So making any kind of connection to the 110 volt line with something like an oscilloscope, you got to go kind of slow and careful. If you're doing it with a thoroughly shielded, floating, modern-day digital voltmeter, which is inside of a plastic package, and you connect those two probes of the DVM to the 110 volt line, that's a relatively safe operation because of the outer plastic shielding on that piece of instrumentation. But oscilloscopes don't have that most of the time. Maybe some of the more modern day, completely portable, packaged, plastic encased oscilloscopes would be something like a DVM, but very few of us own.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Very few of us own one of those yet because they're kind of expensive and a little bit rare. Before I pass it over to Glenn, was there another person signing in just now? Give me your call letters again. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2EK.
I hear Eric. And I think earlier we also heard KD2 EMS. But Eric, go right ahead and put in your comment.
There's been many opportunities where I've had to use the scope across the 110 volt line, making switching power supplies. And the easiest trick is to use a really perfectly good isolation transformer. And a little bit of safety thoughts, and you don't really have an issue with that. So just a quick comment. K2RIW,
very fine, Eric. During that transmission, twice it sounded like you were on high power, twice it sounded like you were on very low power. So would you flip back and forth between a lot of hiss in the background and very little hiss in the background? Just thought you'd like to know that. So something funny was going on, and it happened with four transitions during that transmission. Let's call it high, low, so to speak, in what it looked like was your power output. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a couple of other things I wanted to mention here, too, about measurements with, conducted emissions on a power line. Usually, if you can measure within an oscilloscope a RF signal, in other words, if you're keying down your transmitter and you're seeing on the power line a signal where you can actually measure voltage on there, and you're really seeing an RF envelope on the RF power line, that's a lot of RF energy on a power line, probably more than you really want. And I still feel that you need to go back to the source and fix the problem there. And there's a couple of suggestions I would offer here, if that's really the case, rather than trying to put filters on every piece of equipment inside the house, is to go back to the transmitter and look at two things. One is, how is the power supply decoupled to the ground in other words, how the safety ground is connected. Is that a proper ground, number one? Let me let it drop for a second. And the second thing I would look at would be, and this is probably the most critical point, is if there's an antenna tuner in the system, there is something where, especially if it's like a large antenna outside, like an 80-meter antenna, and an antenna tuner is being used to correct for a pretty imbalanced kind of a VSWR problem, and basically when the antenna gets tuned, you see a good match, but what could be happening is that the grounding system that the antenna is connected to could be the power line system or the safety earth inside the shack. And what is actually happening is when the tuner is being tuned, the safety ground inside the house is being used partly as a counterpoise to try to tune the antenna. I think what I would try to do is, if anything, try to ground the antenna box to the outside. In other words, you can ground transceiver to amplifier to the antenna tuner, tie those together. But the only safety ground that should be going back to the wall outlet should be from the power supply itself. The rest of the ground should try to go to the outside ground, if possible, to keep circulation currents from the antenna system to go back into the grounding system of the household. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions now, Glenn. And by the way, Glenn, once during that transmission, I did hear some hiss on your signal, too, so I'm beginning to think now it's not Eric's problem. There's a source of a hissing noise that happens periodically on either of those two signals. A amateur radio transmitter running from a 110-volt line is inside of a reasonably well-shielded metal box. On the back panel is usually a UHF connector. And assuming you've got a piece of coaxial cable as your transmission line and the connectors are well installed, you now have a thoroughly shielded system from the actual transmitter inside the box all the way down the center conductor of the transmission line up to the antenna. Everything is completely shielded. So the transmitter in that case isn't attempting to launch a signal with reference to Earth as a counterpoise. Assuming your antenna itself is a balanced antenna, or assuming that it has the right kind of a balancing device at the end of the transmission line where it connects to the antenna, then your transmission line outer shield is not going to become hot, and everything is about as good as it can be along those lines. When I suddenly add an antenna tuner, which is another shielded box after the transmitter, and there's that hiss in the background, another shielded cable between the transmitter and the antenna tuner, input, the antenna tuner itself is in a shielded box, and then from the output of the antenna tuner, another shielded cable going up to the antenna. So here's my question. Whether the transmitter is feeding the antenna directly, or whether I'm feeding it through an antenna tuner, I don't think there's any real difference as to whether or not the antenna tuner has the ability to start using the grounding system.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I don't think the antenna tuner has any kind of excess magic or lack of magic, so to speak, when it comes to using the grounding system as a counterpoise anywhere differently than the transmitter would. And so there would be no grounding system counterpoise problem, launching current in the ground, so to speak, if the antenna has the right kind of balun at the end, which could be a poor man's balun, a couple of turns of coax held together with black tape, if you know what I mean, or a tie wrap. That's a kind of an RF choke, making sure that there's no RF current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. So, assuming the antenna is not causing the problem, I'm having trouble believing that the antenna tuner could still do it. Give us a couple of words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
On HF, Dick, I've seen this happen many, many times. And what happens is, in other words, what's really going on here is that normally the safety ground on the piece of equipment in a power supply usually has a third pin plug that goes into the wall outlet, and that goes back someplace. And usually when I've seen this kind of problem happen is usually when there's an antenna tuner being used and you don't have a very, very good balanced system. And what's usually happening is the, like you're saying, your cables that are matching, in other words, the match between the radio to the antenna tuner is seeing a fairly decent match. So there's no circulation currents between the chassis of the radio and the protective earth ground. But what will happen is somewhere down the line, somebody daisy chains, like goes in the back of the radio, and we'll take a group of grounds and tie the transceiver, the power supply, and the antenna tuner case all together, and then drop another wire down onto something that's close to either the protective earth itself or somewhere inside the shack, basically causing an issue. So now what's happening is when you're tuning the antenna tuner, especially on something like 80 meters, and you start tuning the tuner, what's happening is currents from the antenna tuner start flowing through the ground of the antenna tuner box into the grounding system. So now what's happening is as you're tuning the box, you're actually tuning the internal grounding part of the house as part of the counterpoise, and you start to generate RF currents inside the house. There was another device that MFJ sold for a while that really caused this problem. It was called their artificial ground unit. Basically, you tuned this artificial ground to help or alleviate a matching problem inside your house, and it would literally drive a counterpoise as part of your internal house. Tremendous RFI generator. I'm pretty sure you might have seen a couple of these devices, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
KD2AMZ.
AMZ recognized.
Gentlemen, right now, in the terms of the ground, all my equipment is going to a ground bus, basically a copper pipe. From that copper pipe, I have a number 8 cable going to a separate ground rod, which is driven no more than like 4 to 5 feet from all my equipment. And all my equipment is not daisy chained. It's all home runs to the ground bus, which then goes out to the ground. So just kind of keep that in mind. So I still think it's the antenna doing its job by radiating, the energy, and it just so happens that the house wiring is just resonant, and that's what I think is really happening.
And to exchange the comments.
Here's your offer. Okay. Go ahead, Wes.
Just a short comment. Model MFJ. 934 that I have, antenna tuner and artificial ground. The thing that was made by MFJ, on left hand side they have a ground matching which contains of the inductance and capacitance knobs. Looking at it right now, on the right hand side there is a typical P filter antenna tuner, so kind of interesting structure. I've never used it at the left-hand side. I wonder if Glenn played with that. In the middle, you have a two curves meter, one to the right, one to the left, and it's a multifunction meter. And there is a switch, ground, current, or forward power. Enter it.
I'm guessing that these tuned ground systems of MFJ, among others, are intended for what I'm going to call an unbalanced antenna, something like an NFED ZEP or a long wire antenna, where you're feeding one end of a piece of wire with reference to earth. And now the amount of lead length, so to speak, between your transmitter, which might be on the second floor of the house or the 17th floor of an apartment building, back to earth so that you're able to find a counterpoise, so to speak, by which you can feed this long wire or NFED ZEP. In that particular case, having a tuned ground could help. I didn't say it's going to stop television interference. It can certainly increase it. But at least as far as having the ability to radiate with that long wire antenna, it could help. And what would happen if your transmitter is on the second floor of the house and, let me pick a number, it's 25 feet off the ground, and you're feeding a long wire antenna, the real transmitter is now launching, it's trying to pump current, so to speak, on the first half cycle into the antenna. At the same time, it's got to be taking current from somewhere else. Well, it's the case of the radio. And now the radio has got a ground lead that you've installed, or... It's part part of the wiring of the house by way of the third prong, but that that ground lead now goes, in my example, more than 25 feet before it reaches earth, so that what you think is the length of your end-fed ZEP really is the length of the end-fed ZEP plus the length of that wiring back to earth, and the transmitter is somewhere in the middle of that system. And so resonating that that so-called grounding system can improve your ability to launch a signal into that end-fed ZEP antenna. It may not be the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It may not be the most desirable way to do it, but it is one way to at least increase the amount of signal that goes out there. I'm going to turn it over to Glenn for some further comments on this. And by the way, Glenn, I'm having trouble seeing a difference as to a transmitter is launching a signal between center conductor and shield of the coax. That's all the transmitter does. He's acting as a voltage generator, and you could say the voltage generator, one lead goes to the center conductor of the output coax, the other lead goes to the case of the transmitter, which is the shield of the transmission line. Transmitter does that. I'm having trouble believing that a normal antenna tuner does anything different. It also has an output circuit, quite often a PI or an L-PI or an L-network, which is launching a signal into the center conductor of the final output transmission line with reference to the shield of that transmission line. It itself is not, it has no ability to say, I want to launch the signal into ground. It's launching it between center conductor and shield. And if now your antenna, because of a lack of a balance at the antenna, launches signal back down on the outside of the coax, yes, the whole system can become hot. Not because of the antenna tuner, but because of your antenna. And yes, as you operate the controls on the antenna tuner, and you do and don't get a better and worse impedance match, and you do and don't launch more signal into the antenna, and if the antenna itself is launching signal back down the outside of the coax, and you're now measuring the current, the RF current flowing between the antenna tuner and earth, yes, you will see that current go up and down as you operate the controls of the antenna tuner. And you'll think the antenna tuner is doing it. What I think is doing it is your antenna, and you're launching more and less signal into the antenna, and that's the real cause, is my guess. KC2QIQ.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2QIQ. K2LAW. Very Glenn.
Absolutely, Dick. You've hit the nail right on the head of exactly what the problem is. The purpose of my... There is no difference between the transceiver and the antenna tuner. But the reason I brought up the antenna tuner as a separate module in this particular case is because this is a... Now, it's normally, when we're operating up on VHF and UHF and we have balanced antennas and a nice coaxial cable coming inside, everything, we have an antenna that's balanced, a cable that comes in, goes in the back of the radio, no interference problems. We get into the HF category, these 80-meter antennas, 75-meter antennas, 40 meters, and getting long wires, just like you described before. And what will happen is most of our antenna tuners that are built into the radio on these HF radios, they'll do 3-to-1, but if you need something that's going to give you a little bit more so you can adjust, you know, going on, you know, maybe 17 meters and some of these other bands in between, you're going to use an external tuner. So usually the tuner is the indicator that there's a antenna that where the match of it is not close to the frequency that you're that they're initially operating on, and they're doing some additional tuning where the tuner really is part of the antenna system that requires the match. So that's the only real purpose of me bringing out the idea of the tuner there. It was just to explain that that's usually an indicator that, that those kinds of problems can exist. And usually one of the ways of eliminating that is looking at the connection of grounds on the back of the setup and trying to separate, in those particular cases, the grounding wire from the antenna tuner and moving it around a little bit, like you had mentioned before, and determining which one is the better ground for the antenna, trying to make the antenna ground system on the outside look more like the antenna than inside the house, having the you know, your power utility ground as being the better RF ground. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As you guys are listening, you can tell the word ground, when it comes to an RF circuit, has got a lot of very relativistic words. When it comes to 60 cycle power, having your equipment properly grounded, the safety wiring and other auxiliary grounds, has a lot of very specific meaning. But when it comes to the word RF ground, wow. If you're operating on, let's pick a number, 432 megacycles, where each wavelength is 27 inches in air, and you're on the second floor of a house, and you think you have grounded your transmitter, so that now there's not going to be any RF current flowing in funny places. Well, because you're on the second floor, and the true Earth, Mother Earth, is 25 feet away from you, which is probably more than 20 wavelengths away, so no matter how wide that ground strap is between your equipment and that earthing rod outside of the shack, no matter, I don't care if it's a great big wide blade, you know, a braid of copper 3 inches wide, you think you've got a very low inductance, very low impedance, very low resistance connection between your transmitter and that grounding rod. In reality, that grounding system I just described is 20 wavelengths long. And so you can launch a beautiful signal into it under certain conditions, and it can become an antenna. And until you make it into an infinitely wide sheet of conducting material, the inductance of that length and the number of wavelengths is going to give you more than enough ability to launch a signal into it. So the word ground at RF frequencies takes on some very different meanings. And you'll hear people discussing in all kinds of ways and arguing with each other. And there's a ridiculous number of people who believe,
repeater, time out, cancel.
Question. I hear you, Wes. There's a ridiculous number of people who believe that because you've got television interference, that all you have to do is to establish a better ground and the television interference is going to disappear. 90-some-odd percent of the time, I believe that is not true. So just plain grounding is not enough. You got to really figure out what is the mechanism by which the signal is being radiated by your system and getting into something else, lighthouse wiring or telephone wiring, and then how is it getting from there into the offended piece of equipment that has the susceptibility? Is it because there wasn't enough of a line filter on the input? And most things that we own these days do not contain this very expensive item called an RF isolating line filter. My words for it, but you know what I mean. That's quite a few dollars, and almost none of the consumer products we buy contain.
Dick, haven't checked the CE mark, KC2QIQ.
What do you mean? Are you saying that the CE mark forces there to be a certain number of decibels of isolation, and would every one of them pass 10 volts of RF on the cable? Over to you on that one, Glenn.
Here, Jeff. Eric recognized. So for the home standard, it's 3 volts per meter, 3 volts per meter radiated, and 3 volts RMS conducted. So 3 volts RMS conducted on the line, and that's, you know, been the standard now probably, I think, back since 97. So pretty much any equipment that was sold internationally with the CE mark on it had to meet that minimum requirement, which is a pretty darn good EMI susceptibility kind of requirement. So I would think that that's fairly decent. I mean, the surge in 97 wasn't the greatest. They've been improving that better and better and better. But CE has been around for a while, Dick. 97, if it's got a CE mark on it, really should not have a problem. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
However, I got a problem right here, though. Where Mike held his field strength meter near his outlets and got significant deflection, I think there's a high probability the specific amount of RF voltage on his 110-volt line of his house could easily be considerably stronger than 3 volts. What do you think, Glenn?
Oh, I completely agree, Dick, but the point that I'm making here is there's a reason why CE and IEC and everybody and the FCC came up with the 3 volt per meter standard, is because that's a fairly staunchy amount of noise that you're putting on your ground system. In other words, chances are, if you had something that was could meet 10 volts per meter, it would still probably cause a problem, is what I'm basically trying to say. So if he fixes the problem at the source, in this particular case, which I'm pretty sure is going to be, it's going to come back to either his antenna or something with the antenna system and or the antenna system grounding. If he fixes that, that'll go away. It'll bother nothing. And I think you probably agree with that. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
From Mike's description, my first guess is that his antenna is radiating the way it's supposed to. His wiring is in the near field of the antenna, the house wiring. And the house wiring just happens to have a physical layout that's resonant at his frequency, which may be his 80 meters. And if that is true, unless he rewires his house in a significant way, that problem at the source, the 110-volt wiring, being the receiving antenna for what his real antenna is radiating, there's no simple solution for that one, in my particular guess. Now, we've got Wes and Eric in that order.
Aerofacet was a really good solution for it.
I'm listening.
One of the things that I would always suggest, and I mean, if possible, I mean, granted, you know, these are problems that sometimes we have to band-aid with filters and other things. But if you really want to have your ideal ham shack, the beautiful thing to do is, if it's available and you can do it, is the room that you're setting up all of your amateur radio equipment inside of, is to run specifically dedicated power lines back to your fuse panel. So wherever your fuse panel, when your energy comes in from the street, drops down by the meter, put in the extra circuit breakers inside there and run dedicated lines directly back to you for your amateur radio shack. And run inside there. Don't put anything else on it. Don't use daisy-chained outlets that are going to other lighting fixtures, televisions, and other things in the house. This way, if that room, it's got its own isolated breaker, it's got all that equipment on it, and that in itself will save a lot of aggravation for other interference within the house. Trust me on this one. K2SFU, KC2QIQ.
KD2AMZ, re-comment again real quick.
Yeah, hold on a minute, Mike. If Mike had a completely separate line from his fuse panel to his ham radio shack, and his ham radio equipment is not directly launching signals into that wiring that supplies power to his shack, that his antenna doing the radiating is sending out a signal that is picked up by the rest of the wiring of the house, which happens to have a resonant layout, and the rest of the wiring of the house connects to the television set. So in that particular...
That could be proved in 2 minutes. You know how?
Didn't he sort of prove that when he ran the television set separately by way of a UPS? But go ahead, Glenn.
First of all, I don't believe it, number one. And number two is that if it was resonant, the easiest way to find out is to take your VFO dial at on low power and look at this problem and just move your VFO back and forth very, very shortly and write down the frequencies of which you're getting disturbance. If it happens on one dominant frequency and harmonics of that frequency, you know you got a resonance issue. If it doesn't happen and it's happening relatively broadband around that frequency, you know it's basically just current going into the ground system. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
When he took his field strength meter and went to the various outlets in the house and got a deflection, Glenn, tell me how you think the RF got into those outlets.
I think what's happening is on the antenna, I could be wrong, but more than likely I think what's happening is the antenna is being tuned up with an antenna tuner of some device on that particular frequency, and every time he changes frequency and retunes the tuner, what he's doing is he's making the house resonant with the antenna tuner. That's what I think is actually happening. But so in other words, the house is actually being forced to become part of the system. So unless he breaks that ground loop between the protective earth ground in the house and the antenna system, it'll always retune it back into the house's the grounding system.
Wow. So if the resonance is the physical layout, the dressing, so to speak, of the wiring of the house, let's assume now that one of his lengths of wire in the house is the equivalent of electronically 132 feet long, which is a half wave at 80 meters. And because it's really folded in funny ways, it's a zigzagged 132 feet with capacitive loading on the end of various appliances. So the layout of the wire firing of the house is resonant at 80 meters, in my example. His antenna 30 feet away is radiating a signal on 80 meters. That signal coming off the antenna in the proper way goes out in space into all directions, encounters the wiring of the house, and says, aha, here's another resonator, and builds up a nice big voltage. And you feel that the antenna tuner is causing that physical layout of the wiring of the house to have that resonance. And that antenna tuner is inside of a shielded box with a shielded piece of cable going up to the antenna. I'm having trouble with that one, Glenn. But we got a waiting list here of people. Wes, Eric, and Mike, in that order, have said they want to make some further comments. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Another test to do, Dick, is just change the antenna. Try a different antenna. KC2QIQ.
Oh, yeah, if you had another dipole at right angles to this one, the problem would go away if he's willing to put up another antenna. I agree with you. Go ahead, Wes.
We have an antenna with artificial ground. Or we have a dipole antenna or that uses the ground or the counterpoise. And let's say this is a physical ground. Not a ground that I have in here in my MFJ. In half of a cycle, in the dipole, one side is emitting the signal. Then in another, the second half of the cycle, the ground is the one that is active. Would you please, Glenn, Dick, and John, tell me, what is the characteristic of that radiating ground, and what is the special looks like in tri-dimension of that field? And so again.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconception on this one as to what the transmission line is doing on a properly operating center-fed half-wave dipole. Back in the old days, 1925, the average ham radio operator was living in a wooden house. He was relegated to the attic of the house. He set up his transmitter on a wooden table in the middle of that attic. He wanted to put up an 80-meter dipole. He ran 67 feet of wire out the eastern window, 67 feet of wire out the western window. Those two pieces of wire came together at the wooden table, and the transmitter sat in the center. The transmitter was an RF pump in the center of that dipole. That's the way a well-equipped ham radio operator in 1925 might do his operation. Well, eventually we got permission to be in other portions of the house, bedrooms, basement, and whatever. And now you run a transmission line down there. But what the transmission line is trying to do, it's trying to act like the transmitter in the middle of the dipole. In either case, whether the transmitter is really there or it's the transmission line acting like the transmitter is there, it's very similar also to the example I give with Arnold Schwarzenegger in space. Let me drop.
Dick, WHCDL, I got to mention something to you.
I'm listening.
Did Mike inform you that this happens in two locations? I spoke to him on the phone today. This originally started in his Pennsylvania location, and the reason why he got this set, the TV set, came from his neighbor. He was explaining to me because his neighbor was getting interference, and he made a trade. But he explained that it was happening in Pennsylvania as well as this location.
What I don't know is the common denominator of the television set. Is it the television set that got moved, the ham radio equipment that got moved? What moved between Pennsylvania and Long Island? You didn't make that clear, Andy. Go ahead.
I think he's on frequency. I think he can explain it better than me.
Okay, I'll explain it. This is KDQAMZ. The TV and my ham setup was changed. I used a different transmitter. An ICOM 718, which exhibits the same problem as my older Kenwood TS-430S. I also used a different antenna in Pennsylvania than I'm using here. So it's just, and I really think it's just a coupling. The antenna is launching the RF, and the house wiring just happens to be more or less resonant. When I take and I pump this thing into a dummy low, Dick, the problem disappears immediately. So I am convinced it's not my transmitter. It's because when I go into a dummy load, the problem is completely gone. So I really think it's the antenna launching a signal and the house wiring. Like I said, just happens to be a resonant circuit. And what's happening is the RF is, aha, here's a resonant circuit, and away we go. That's what I really think the situation is.
I agree with you, Mike. And by the way, the antenna, the household wiring being resonant is an aggravating factor. In some cases, if the television set is sufficiently susceptible, in other words, it's a set that is very vulnerable to RF energy on the 110-volt line, creating a phony response on the touchpads on the front panel of the set. If it's a very susceptible set, then it might not even require resonance of the household wiring. Just any RF pickup of the household wiring will do it. And again, the manufacturer, depending on whether it's got this CE rating that Glenn is talking about, it still is not sufficiently shielded, is the best guess. But let me finish the comment I was making to Wes, and that is, we keep forgetting about how do you feed a half-wave dipole. On the first half cycle, the transmission line or transmitter located at the center of the dipole is acting as a pump. It's pumping charge from one place into another. On one half cycle, it is pumping charge from the left-hand side of the dipole to the right-hand side of the dipole. On the second half cycle, it pumps charge from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. You've got to take it from somewhere to put it somewhere. You could say a half-wave dipole is its own counterpoise.
Oh, you didn't understand that. What I was trying to say is that there is an active part that is emitting the signal out. In a typical horizontal dipole, G5RV, let's say, half of a cycle, one side, left-hand side, is the one that is active. The other one acts as a counterpoise. Then, in the second part of the cycle, you have a reverse situation. That's one of the scenarios. Now, what you're doing, you're taking a different structure at which a counterpoise or the ground is a part of an antenna, a typical dipole. Now, in half of a cycle, the dipole, the physical wire of the dipole is the transmitting part, and then the ground supposed to be a transmitting part in the second half. I ask you about spatial characteristic of the ground emitting radio wave. And to Adrian.
You are saying that the dipole, one half is active and the other half is not active on each half cycle.
One, the counterpoise, and the other one is acting as the active element, and reverse.
You got to stop saying that. I do not agree with that. Let me try it again. You don't have to have a insulator in the center of the dipole. The dipole could be a half wavelength long piece of wire. You could be feeding it from the outer edge. The current flows from the left-hand side to the right-hand side on the first half cycle, and you're about to say the right-hand side is active. Absolutely not. The whole darn thing is active. You're moving charge from the left side to the right side. The side you're taking the charge from is equally as active as the side you're putting the charge into. That's all. That's when you put the insulator in the center. If you're not putting the insulator in the center, the current flows the exact same way. If there was no insulator in the center, are we again going to say the left side is even when you got the insulator in the center? So the whole darn thing is active. So a dipole properly fed with the right kind of a balancing device from the transmission line to the dipole means that only the dipole radiates and the transmission line does not radiate. Let me drop.
He's homosexual!
And now, if you don't have the right kind of a balancing device, Mother Nature wants there to be a balance. When you're feeding a dipole, if your transmitter is trying to put plus 10 volts onto the right side, at that exact same instant of time, it's trying to put minus 10 volts on the left side. It's equal and split at all instants of time. That's what Mother Nature wants the dipole to do. And if you've simply fed the transmission line shield to the left side and the center conductor to the right side, and Mother Nature is trying to create that balance, plus 10 volts to the right, minus 10 volts to the left, you will be launching the minus 10 volts down the outside shield of the coax. That's what happens if you don't use a bell in there. In that case of a properly fed, properly balanced dipole, there is no counterpoise. You're feeding the symmetric center of a dipole. The kind of antenna that needs a counterpoise is something like a quarter wave ground plane. So we're getting some of this confused. Now, I know that Eric wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Okay. KQRIW. Oh, let me see. That's noise. I got a couple of problems with this conversation that I'm hearing. You know, the difference between balanced and unbalanced. First, just let me state my case in terms of what you guys are calling an antenna tuner. There's no such thing. It's a misnomer. It's a transmission line matching device or a transmitter matcher. As long as you've got that shielded cable between it and the box, nothing should radiate from there. But, in any event, I'm not clear on the TV set where you have the problem, because there are some modern-day TV sets. Let me better drop for a second. Modern-day TV sets, you have touch controls on many of the sets, which are capacitively operated devices. And even the slightest amount of RF on some of the earlier versions of the sets will cause them to not function or to operate in ways that you can't imagine, which wouldn't necessarily indicate that there's anything wrong with the antenna system. Oh, by the way, most of the antennas that I use in the broadcast world are all at ground. You can consider them DC ground, and if you consider how they're fed, you know, the RF ground is way different from the DC ground, so I think a lot of folks get that a little confused in terms of, you know, wanting to ground your radios and ground it to the antenna tuner and have it go to a ground state. It's not really a bad idea at all. Actually, it saves you a lot of grief in some cases, but that really shouldn't be part of the RF ground system. If you've got a proper balancing device at the end, and by the way, I know he said that he put it into a load, but did he put it into a load where the antenna is, not at the back of the transmitter, so that he's got the load on the entire system. Also, with modern-day transmitters, the way the power supplies are, the way the chassis is isolated from the line, that also makes me scratch my head a little bit. But it's just a few things to think about. K2RIW, K2J.
You're onto something here, Eric. It ain't simple. When you got television interference, yes, if this is the most ideal world, you would have been putting the dummy load at the far end of the transmission line, if there was a connector out there. Assuming he's got a reasonably integrity of his transmission line and properly installed connectors on both ends, putting the dummy load in the shack is, in my opinion, a good test. It's not perfect. It's a necessary but not sufficient. But I think it tests 90% of the system. I think it does give us a fairly strong hint that the proper radiation of the dipole itself, coupled into the household wiring, coupled into a susceptible television set, is the combination. One solution is to go out and buy a less susceptible set. That's not so desirable. And it looks like by various techniques with some other heroics, he's managed to create greater isolation between that 110-volt line and the TV set. And it looks like for the time being, it has calmed down. By the way, a little bit later on, Glenn, if you're still with us, KC2QIQ, I'm going to be asking you a very interesting question about the so-called two-capacitor problem, which is now a very interesting piece of information that came to my attention with reference to, is it the magnetic field, or is it the electromagnetic field that's doing the radiating in free space? We'll get into that later. I think we've spent enough time on this particular one for now, Mike. And Mike, you've got a sufficiently interesting problem that's sufficiently wide world as far as, you know, a lot of people run into things like this. You're allowed to bring this up again next week, Mike, if you want to. Any final comments, Mike? KD2AMZ, K2RAW in the TechNet.